first time in the history of the world, the great vision of religion was proclaimed in the Purusha Sutta of the Veda, which can be regarded as the most magnificent vision bequeathed to us by the ancient masters. To the seers of the Veda, religion was life. The way they conducted themselves was their religion. What they spoke was their religion. And the vision that they had about things in the world was their religion. Religion was not a textbook. It was not a scripture. It was not a study. It was not something heard from other people. It was something that was seen directly. This seeing is called the Veda. It is called Darshana, the vision integral. Not the vision of the eyes or the ears or the sense organs. It is not perception, but intuition. It is Sakshatkara or realization, an immediate contact with the quintessential essence of things. Not immediate contact as we have through the senses in respect of the objects of the world. Thus, in the vision, which is the Purusha Sukta, we have a masterly stroke, unparalleled in religious history, where man ceases to be man in his envisagement of the cosmic man, whom he designates in the language of these mantras as the Purusha Supreme. Those of you who might have heard of this great hymn of the Veda will know what it actually connotes. It is a short prayer, or you may say it is an exclamation, a song, an ecstatic expression of a tremendous upheaval that took place within the recesses of the being of the great sage who had this vision. The central principle of the culture of the whole of Bharatavarsha can be said to be impregnated within this single small poem, Purusha Sukta. All the scriptures are ramifications, commentaries, explanations, annotations, etc., of this central truth. Or rather, we may say the other way around, everything else that is said in the other parts of the Veda is also a large commentary, as it were, on this little poem called the Purusha Sukta. It is a little big poem where man contacts God. Man in his essence comes in contact with God in his essence. And to this day, it is the accepted tradition of the culture of this country that religion has to be a life. Actually, very important to remember here, religion is not what you do in the empirical sense. It is what you see with your eyes. What you see with your eyes is your religion, not what you do with your hands and feet. If you do worship with the hands and see an image with eyes made of stone, you are not practicing religion. If it is only a portrait that you are worshipping, and the eyes see only a portrait, the hands are waving a sacred lamp, that is not religion. You may wave any lamp, you may do anything
with your hands and mutter anything with your tongue. But what is He? He is your Lord. If you see only a temple erected by a mason and an image that is installed of metal or stone, this is not religion. So religion is vision, seeing, and nothing more, nothing less. So here is India's religion before you. If you want to know what India's religion is, it is not any nomenclature that can be attached to this religion. All these names that are associated with the forms of religion in the world are later developments in the history of mankind. A vision is not a racial prerogative. The one who had this vision of the Purusha, of the Purusha Sukta, was not a Hindu, was not a Christian, was not a Muslim, he was not a man. When man has vision of God, he no more remains as man. Because man is the name that we give to an embodiment whose faculty is a conglomeration of sense organs. You can recall to your mind the words of Sri Krishna, as recorded in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, "These eyes cannot see me." Arjuna's two eyes could not have the vision of the great Purusha who embodied himself in that description of the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. What the Purusha Sukta means in the Veda, the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita also means. They are one and the same. One is a Shruti, another is a Smriti. By a Shruti we mean a sacred lore that has come down to us by the lineage of Guru and disciple. It does not come through libraries or textbooks. These sacred mantras were listened to by the disciple and chanted, recited or taught by the Guru. By a little digression, before I go into the meaning of the Purusha Sukta, I would like to mention to you the system followed in the study of the Veda in India. It is not like study in a college or a university with which you are acquainted. The Veda cannot be chanted so easily. In a way, we may compare the system of the study of the Veda mantras to the study of music. You cannot read a book of music and become a musician. It requires a practical guidance from a person who can sing for you. You have to listen to the singing and then only you can learn music. A mere notation in a book will not be a sufficient aid in the learning of music. The mantra of the Veda. By the way, the verses of the Vedas are called mantras. There are Sanskrit poems called verses in English. There are two types of verses. One is called the Shruti, another is called the Smriti. The verses of the Vedas are called mantras. They are not called shlokas, because they are charged with the divine potency. The verses of all other writings, including the Bhagavad Gita, Ramayana, Mahabharata, Manusmriti, whatever it is, are called shlokas. Great saying. A shloka is a well said saying. And a mantra is distinguished from an ordinary verse in this sense, that a mantra is a vibration pressed into the configuration or form of a group of expressions called words or language. The mantra of the Veda is therefore condensed energy. It is not a word in an ordinary sense. It is not a language that you speak when you chant the mantra of the Veda. You are giving expression to a tremendous force. And therefore, your apparatus within also should be trained to receive the potency of the mantra which you are going to recite or chant. The modulation of the voice is very important, the intonation, as your raga in music. There is swara in the Veda. There are 4 feet of every mantra. And when the Veda mantra is taught, the teacher, the guru, does not recite the whole at one stroke. I am one of those, I should say, fortunate ones, who had the occasion to study these Vedas under a very holy man, and I know how it is taught and how it is learned. A foot is chanted first, and the student recites it 3 times. And the second foot is recited by the guru. The student recites it 3 times. The third foot is chanted. Then the student recites it 3 times. The fourth foot is chanted. And he recites it again 3 times. This goes on 3 times again. This recitation of a foot 3 times goes on 3 times. So it is 9 times recitation of a single foot. Then the guru chants 2 feet at one stroke. That is half the mantra, half the verse you must say, which again has to be conducted in the same manner 3 times, 3 times, 9 times again. So you know how many times it has been recited. Then the whole mantra is chanted, not only half. Again 3 times. The process repeated again 3 times, so that 9 times once again. When this is completed, the student will know the whole mantra by heart, automatically. He need not go on racking his head. It is like a mathematics. If this process is complete, you know it by heart automatically, immediately the mantra is complete. And you get up with great satisfaction, now I know what it is. See, what a system they have introduced. And likewise every mantra. And religious men study the whole Rig Veda, for instance, which consists of some 10,000 mantras, 10,000. And to study it in this way, how much time it will necessary? Some 4 years at least must be taken. And to study the 4 Vedas, it may take a large number of years, sometimes 12 years at least. Nobody studies the 4 Vedas. Each one is supposed to belong to one particular Veda. And myself belong to the Rig Veda school, and some belong to the Yajurveda school, some Sama Veda. Nobody belongs to the Atharva Veda. That is an appendix to the Veda. The religious essence of the Veda is in the 3 texts called Rig, Yajur, Sama. The 4th is only an appendix. That is not studied generally. Well, so this is how the Veda mantras are recited. Seated in a holy posture, facing the east, washing the mouth after taking bath, and not getting up in the middle until the study is complete. The mantra is a great power. Why is it a power? Christ says somewhere in his gospel that what he spoke was not merely a word. It was spirit that came from his mouth. As I told you last time, all great men think alike, whether it is a Christ or a seer of the Veda, they tell the same thing finally. It is spirit that came out from the mouth of the great chanter of the mantra of the Veda. And when you are reciting it, you are getting enrapport with this great spirit that is enshrined in the mantra of the Veda. Such a mantra is here before you in the form of the Purusha Sukta. How is it chanted? There are three types of intonation. Sometimes a combination of all the three. The three we call Udatta, Anudatta and Swarita. These are technical words of the Vedic language. You chant a passage with a lifted voice and with a lowered voice and without raising or lowering but with a middling voice. These are the three ways. These are the three ways. And each mantra, each verse, each passage involves these three types of intonation. This is the difficulty in the recitation of a mantra. You have the famous Mahamrityunjaya, for instance. This comes in the Veda. This is a Veda mantra. Let us not now think of the Purusha Sukta for the time being. It is a longer one. Look at this mantra. Mahamrityunjaya. I am taking this as an instance because you are all acquainted with it. You are chanting it. There are three types of intonation in this mantra, if you have properly observed. You please listen to the way in which I am chanting it, according to the accepted tradition. Triyambakam yajamahi. This is 1 foot. I mentioned to you there are 4 feet. Triyambakam yajamahi. That is one. The second foot. Sugandhim Vushtivardhanam. Second foot. Uruvarukaviva Bandhanat. That is third foot. Mrityor Mutri Yamamrutat is the fourth foot. Now, Triyam, that is elongated and raised. It is called Swarita. Triyam Ba. The Ba is neither top nor below. It is just in the middle. You don't say Ba like that. It is Ba. So it is the middling voice. Triyam Ba Kam. Ba and Ka are middle. They are in a straight line. They don't walk like Triyam. Triyam has gone up. Triyam Bakam Yajamahi. One line straight. Su, you have come down immediately. Su Gandhim. Again you have gone up. So you see the three intonations are in 1 foot itself. Triyam Bakam Yajamahi. Su. There you lower the voice. That is called Anudatta. Su Gandhim. That is Swarita. Push T. Again down you have come. Vardhanam. How can you chant it unless somebody teaches you? You won't know where it is to be up, where it is to be down. Otherwise it will be like a broken music. The musician will say, what kind of student is this music? Uru, va, ru. You see, all the three are low. Uru, va, ru are, all the three are lowered voice. Uru, va, ru, ka, mi, va. Again, mi goes up and va down. Bandhana, da goes up. Mrut, again down. Mrityor mu, mu goes up. Shi ja, lie down. Ma mruta atata goes up. I don't know whether any of you know this. And this is one example of a Veda mantra. And sometimes all the three are combined and it is more difficult to chant. I will not touch all these things just now. So these are techniques of intonation which change the meaning also if the intonation changes. This is a speciality of a mantra as distinguished from the ordinary shloka or a verse. Though the words may be the same, if the intonation changes, the meaning will change. You might have heard of the ancient story where some gentleman wanted to produce a daman by the performance of a sacrifice through the chanting of certain mantras to attack Indra. And the performers of the sacrifice were not willing to produce such a daman. They didn't want that some terrific force should come up and attack Indra. And somehow, without knowing the intention of the performer of the sacrifice, they had taken this engagement of performance, and they started the sacrifice. When it was started, he said, my intention is to produce this force to attack Indra. They were in a great perplexed mood. They said, this is very strange, and you want us to do this kind of sacrifice. They could not say no, they could not say yes. Once it is started, they cannot say no. They cannot say yes also, because they don't want to undertake this kind of enterprise. So they chanted the mantra as it was expected, but changed the tune. Immediately, the effect was reversed. A force was generated. Indra Shratro Vriddhasva, that was the mantra. Enemy of Indra, rise up. That was the meaning of mantra. Indra Shratro Vriddhasva. Now, the changing of the tune connoted some peculiarity there. The enemy can be one who attacks or one who is attacked. Both can mean by this word enemy. So the changing of the intonation converted itself into the most unexpected significance. Great force, rise up to be destroyed by Indra. That meaning was introduced. Instead of saying great force, get up to destroy Indra. That was the intention of the man who wanted to perform the sacrifice. But these people who changed the tune got another meaning into it. Great force, rise up to be destroyed by Indra. And you know the story, Vritra got up and great war took place and Indra destroyed. So, Panini in Shiksha, Panini was a great sage, was a master of the grammar of Sanskrit and the phonetics of the recitation of the Veda. He says, if a Veda mantra is not chanted properly according to the required intonation, it may come back upon you like a thunderbolt. And so the tradition of India does not permit the purchase of a book from a shop and reading of it for oneself. You cannot read a chemistry book or a physics book even, what to talk about the Veda mantras. So this is by way of a digression. I have given you some information about the importance of Veda mantras, the glory and the force and potency that is hidden, etc. Now we come to the Purusha Sukta proper, which I said is the foundation of the religion of Bharatavarsha, wherein the vision of the supreme reality is proclaimed at the very outset, in the very beginning. In the first mantra itself, the Sukta says, the great being has countless heads, countless eyes, countless hands and feet. Sahasra shirsha purusha, sahasra atha sahasra paad, the bhumi vishito vritta atyatishtha dashamu. The immanence and the transcendence of the supreme being is declared in this one single mantra. In one mantra with four feet, both the integrality, the comprehensiveness, the absoluteness, the transcendence and the immanence, all are declared. Such is the concise form in which these great ideas have been expressed in this one single mantra. When it is said, it is a being with countless heads and eyes and hands and feet, etc., we remember a parallel passage in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Sarvata Pani Badam Tat Sarvadotri Shuromukham Sarvata Shvatamalloke Sarvamavrati Dishtati. Sarvata Pani Badam, everywhere it has hands and feet. Everywhere it has ears and eyes, says the Bhagavad Gita. Echoing the Purusha Sukta, as I told you, the whole religion of India, in every aspect of it, is centralized in the Purusha Sukta. And you can find there everything that is said anywhere else. So, this great being is all eyes and all ears, all hands and all feet and all limbs and pervading earth and sky. Bhumi Vishyato Vritva Atyatishtha Dasha. The whole universe is pervaded by this. Isha Vasthamidam Sarvam, this is the Upanishad. The same thing is said here, even before that. The whole cosmos is pervaded by this. This is to declare the immanence of God. Now, you will realize that this immanence is of a very special nature. As you go forward, onward, with the study of this Purusha Sukta, you will find that it is a novel type of immanence that is proclaimed here. I give you an example of an ordinary daily occurrence of immanence. You take bath and wash your clothes. You take a bucket of water and put your clothes into the bucket. You will find that the water enters every fiber of the cloth. You may say the water is immanent in the cloth. Immanent because it is inside the cloth. Every little bit of your cloth has been soaked in water. There is no part of the cloth which is not wet. The water is immanent in the cloth. But you know the cloth has not become the water. In spite of the fact that the water has entered every fiber of the cloth. Cloth is cloth, water is water. So this immanence is a very strange thing. It is an impregnation entering into the vitals of the substance, just standing apart in one way. That is why in one passage the Bhagavad Gita, the great Lord says, I am in all things, yet I am in all, not on all things. I am in them, yet I am not in them. They are in me, they are not in me. I am in them, yet I am not in them. The water is in the cloth, yet it is not in the cloth. Because you can drink it out, find dry it and find there is no water there. The water, cloth is once again the same cloth. So water can say, I am in the cloth, yet I am not in the cloth. This is one type of immanence. Water entering into the cloth is one kind of immanence, but there is another kind of immanence, clay becoming pot. Clay has been molded into a pot and clay is immanent in the pot. Now you see the difference between these two types of immanence. You cannot wring the pot out of the clay and have only the pot and minus the clay. That's not possible. When the clay goes, the pot also goes. But here when the water went, the cloth did not go. So that is one kind of immanence, this is another kind of immanence. There have been a history of study, controversy and contemplation on the actual character of the immanence of God in this world. Whether it is as water entering the cloth or as clay entering the pot. How did God enter the world? We shall not enter into this controversy just now. However, the Purusha Sukta says that the Supreme Being has enveloped the whole cosmos. And if He has become the whole cosmos, as clay has become the pot, the entire clay has become the whole pot. There is no clay left out afterwards. There is no transcendence. There is only immanence. God is not only immanence, because if that had been the case, there would have been no creator of the universe. The creator always stands outside the universe. He is a great dictum of Aristotle, for instance. The cause of an effect cannot be identical with the effect. It has to be a little bit away. Otherwise, it cannot be called a cause at all. The whole cause has become the effect. There is no cause. The creator of the universe, he cannot be exhausted in the universe. Hence, then we cannot call him a creator. There is an element of transcendence in certain constitutions or governments. The president, for instance, is a part of the whole nation. Yet he stands above it in some respect. as a super constitutional head. He maintains some power which is super department. Not in every form of government, in certain forms of democratic or republic constitutions. God seems to be transcendent in this way. With a super departmental power, he can set right everything in one stroke if he wants. But he will not interfere with the law operating, as the president does not interfere with the laws of magistrates, courts, etc., imagining that he is above everybody. It is a law that he has himself set in, and therefore the immanence participates in the requirements of the transcendence. As a constitution of the departments of the government may participate and get associated with, yet not contradict, the supremacy of the president. So the Purusha Sukta says, God envelops the whole cosmos, yet transcends it. Atyatishthat. Atyatishthat means goes above. In the homely language of the Veda, the Vedic language is very simple, homely, like a mother speaking, not like a professor proclaiming his knowledge in a college or university. It is a mother or a father very lovingly speaking. That is Veda. So a homely example is given to a child like you. God is above the universe by 10 fingers length. Atyatishtha dashamura. By 10 spans, as it were, he is above the universe. By the word 10, we are supposed to understand that God is not exalted in this world, he stands above the world also. He may be even 1 inch above, it does not matter, yet he is above the world. But the annotators, the understanders and the students of the Veda tell us, 10 does not mean merely the numerical distance of 10 fingers length or 10 inches, 10 cubit, etc. 10 means numberless, because there are only 9 numbers in arithmetic. The last one is a 0. There is no such thing as a 10th number. 1 and 0 make 10. And 0 being not a positive numerical, it is excluded from the series. There are only 9 numbers. So when you say that he has transcended the universe by 10 cubits or 10 spans, 10 inches, etc., they say we have to understand that he is transcended infinitely, not only by a little length of space. Infinitely God transcends the universe, though infinitely he pervades. Sahasra Shirsha Purusha Sahasra Atha Sahasra Pa Bhumi Vishudo Vratva Atyatishtha Dashamura. The declaration that he is all hands and feet, all eyes and heads, shows that he has no limbs. How can there be many things in one place? You cannot have eyes where there are ears. You know very well by common sense that where one thing is, another thing also cannot be there. So how is it that it is said that he is everywhere hands and everywhere feet and everywhere eyes and everywhere heads? There is no meaning in this statement, because all things cannot be everywhere. The idea is that he is neither eyes nor heads nor hands nor feet. These are only symbolic description for our understanding, because we cannot understand anything except in an anthropomorphic human way. It means he can see through the head, walk through the eyes, and speak through the legs. Every limb can perform every other function, not like us, where only eyes can see and ears only can hear and legs only can walk. Every limb can perform every function, every atom of creation can do anything. Every speck of space is filled with every kind of potency, and it is capable of doing anything. All might and supreme omnipotence is hidden within every speck of space, every unit of time, and every atom of matter. Such is God's force. His very existence is force. His very being is power. And being and consciousness come together in the supreme being. This is the connotation hidden behind this symbolic statement that the Supreme Being is all eyes, all heads, etc. Such a inscrutable Almighty is immanent in the whole creation and yet transcendent. This is a short explanation of the first mantra only of the Purusha Sukta. A little more about it I shall tell you later on. Hari Om Tat Sat.